Welcoming into the program, our friend, writer Colin Fleming. Hello there, Mr. Fleming.
What's up, Brother Kimball?
We are ready to cover what I would say is the kind of ground that only Colin Fleming could cover in one segment of radio and make it all somehow make sense.
Well, since you're downtown with Rich Kimball, can I be uptown with Colin Fleming? Because I take you on the other side of the track.
You do that.
That's a little weird. Yeah, you know what I'm talking about.
There's no question.
We cover a lot of ground.
Between us, yeah, we've got the city right under our thumb here. But let's begin our journey today by talking about a 200-year-old work from Percy Bysshe Shelley, Ode to a Skylark.
Yes, Mr. Shelley was out walking one eve with his wife, who happened to be somebody who had written that whole Frankenstein thing, and he heard a skylark. It seems that in English romantic poetry at the time, birds were in the air in more way than one, because our man, Johnny Keats, the year before, had written Ode to a Nightingale, and Shelley would not have, unless they were hanging out, known that poem around this time, because that Keats poem is not going to come out until July of 1820, and neither of these two guys were like these avian masters. They weren't bird experts by any means or anything, but what Shelley does is he hears this bird, and it makes him think about himself in one way, and then humanity as a whole in a larger way, because as a poet, he wants to inhabit this sound, which is a very different kind of sound in that it's of the world, very much so. You're a bird, you're flying around, oh look, there's the world below me, yeah, all that stuff. And it's also beyond the world. And it's hard to pin down. It's this idea of imminence where we have something otherworldly within our own direct purview, and also at the same time something transcendent. And it's all in these very sing-song five-line stanzas. And it has this melodic quality to it that mimics a bird, too, in flight.
And Shelley, I like how he referred to the song of the Skylark as, I believe it was, unpremeditated art.
Right. And I was thinking about that. I was wondering if you'd bring that up, because that is right at the beginning of the poem. And it's two words that really cover so much territory, because it's not the idea of slapdash art, which it could be tempting to read it that way. Unpremeditated art is art that feels fully arrived, completely whole from the moment you first experienced it. Not something that was built up over however long it might have been actual fact have been built up. It's instant. We've talked before on the show about how the very best writers have what I call instant tone. And there's probably six writers who've ever had it. Within six words, you are right into the full belly of the beast of their story. You know the characters, you know the voice, you know the tonal center of the story, you know when we will move away from that tonal center. That's what Shelley is talking about early on. And there's this wonderful twist at the end of the poem where he has all of these similes for this bird in flight. And you come to this stanza where he writes, "We look before and after and pine for what is not. Our sincerest laughter with some pain is fraught. Our sweetest songs are those that tell of saddest thought." There's this theme throughout the poem that a human is never going to be completely happy, but you don't want to be completely happy, because if you're completely happy, you're forsaking variety. You're forsaking the contrast that art itself is going to imbue and encapsulate. And that's this crucial, crucial notion of this poem. And so he ends up imploring this bird to give him more advice, as it were, writing advice, life advice, soul-building advice. You come to the final stanza, "Teach me half the gladness that thy brain must know. Such harmonious madness from my lips would flow. The world should listen then as I am listening now." Now you notice he ends on, I love this, I wonder how many people have ever picked up on this, he ends on the off rhyme. Everywhere else, the rhymes are perfectly clean and clear throughout this entire 21 stanza work, 100 and whatever lines that adds up to. But here he gives you the slightly, ever so slightly discordant note, that sort of perfect imperfection that he himself, as a poet, or this particular narrator poet is striving for.
Let's move from Shelley to the music world and Beethoven's Piano Sonata number 30. What is it about number 30 that makes it memorable?
There's a lot happening with number 30. We are near the end of Beethoven's cycle of sonatas. So there are 32 of them written between 1795 and 1822. So he only has, depending upon how you look at the notations, how these things were ordered, he only has three, four, or five left at this point. And the early sonatas owed a big debt to Haydn. But now we're getting into some Beethoven-y weirdness where he's presaging the 20th century even. Now, sonatas are typically in this form, they're in three parts. But this is in three parts with, again, the idea of a twist, because the first and the second part run together. They're actually linked by the pianist keeping down a pedal. So you have this sustaining bridge between the two, and then the third movement is going to be, there's a gap after the second for most pianists who play this piece. And so it's not even really in three parts. And then the last part, it's quite strange. It's a fugue, which you never get in the final movement of a sonata. And it's also fugato, so it's not even really a fugue. It's making these musical gestures to say, okay, look, this is fugue-like, but we're not completely going there with the whole variation thing, but we're suggesting it to you. And the slow movement, which is usually that middle interlocking part of the three-part sonata form, is now in the third movement. So it's like, oh, Beethoven, what are you doing, bro? And then he has all of these trills that, again, within the movement, serve as linking devices. So it's this very swirling kind of, it's not that dissimilar than from some of the piano music you get in something like Radiohead's Kid A. That's how, like, next century, year 2000, that we're talking about with this work from 1822. It's not how you would have drawn this up. And these classical forms were meant to be adhered to. Beethoven did not adhere to them. He invented new modes through divorcing himself from those earlier forms.
We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown. Let's move to the world of film. And a movie I first saw, I think, in college. And I just remember sitting there slack-jawed trying to figure out what I had seen in a great French avant-garde film, Cocteau's Blood of a Poet. I'm not sure I understand it a lot better today, but it's brilliant.
Definitely one of those films where, oh, it's sort of like cinematic impressionism in a way. But what you had happening here, this is the first part of Cocteau's so-called Orphic trilogy. And this is going to be the most avant-garde entry in that trilogy by far. In fact, you look at the trilogy and you think, okay, do these really, you're kind of roping these in so you can get the trifecta going here. But all right, we'll let you do that. And it's in multiple parts and it's surrealism. There's no way it's not surrealism, but I think most surrealism is pretty terrible because it abandons narrative. And I don't really care much beyond, oh, look, there's a gimmick when I see a dolly clock melting from a tree branch. You see it, and once you've seen it, they're like fireworks. I don't get why people are so into fireworks. To me, you see fireworks once, it's like, okay, got it. Don't really need to see it again. But with Blood of a Poet, there is this narrative track, a vocal track, if you will, overlaid. And it's quite clever. It's kind of some of the sight gags that you get from Buster Keaton from his shorts, not from his features. Or even from Laurel and Hardy silence in their very earliest days, where, for instance, at the beginning, artist sketches a face, and the mouth of the face in the sketch comes to life. And later we have a hermaphrodite, and we have a card sharp, and we have all of this going on, and we have a ritual suicide, and he had these friends, like these rich friends, and he's like, oh yeah, there's going to be this part of the theater, it's really cool, I'd like you to be in my film, can I have some money? And they're like, okay, sure, have some money. It's like, okay, just clap, I'll film you, and then he puts them into the film later, so they're all applauding a suicide. So they said, no way, boyo, cut that out. And he's like, oh, come on, man, it's funny. And they're like, no, it's not even a little bit funny. So it delayed the film like a year because he went ahead and did this. But it will it will fry your brain in
a
really artistic way where you can be like, oh, yes, I'm very smart. Probably like a Dark Side of the Moon laser show, but be a French surrealism.
Let's move to Duke Ellington and a very interesting recording that didn't come out, I believe, for many years after it was recorded live in 1940. Duke Ellington in Fargo, North Dakota, at what was really a dance.
Right. I wrote about this, I think it was for the Smart Set a few years ago, and these two college kids who went to like South Dakota University, but it was a school in South Dakota. So someone like me, the geography out there, I don't know what it means, right? It's not like, oh, I'm in Boston, I'm going to Providence. Like, that means something. Who knows what it means in those big, wide-open spaces. But these two guys wrote Ellington's management, his agency, actually, and said, hey, can we make a field recording? And to give you an idea of just how different things were at the time, they said, okay, sure. You just need to get his permission and tell the band what's going to happen if he grants that permission. So what Ellington and his unit did at the time, it seems not how we would think of him now. And we've made this point in the show when we talked about Jimmy Blanton, Ellington's wonderful bassist, who was not long for the world. And he shines certainly on this live recording. He solos a lot at this dance when you would go and you do the moves of the day. And this unit just happens to be soundtracking your night out as you cut a rug to impress some of the sexy ladies of Fargo, or vice versa. And his unit, this group is insane. They play for a while before Ellington comes on, sits at the piano. And that alone would be like, okay, can't follow that. But you have Johnny Hodges on alto, Ben Webster on tenor saxophone, Blanton, like we mentioned. You have Rex Stewart. This band is just, it's outrageous. And they were working in some new people. So Ellington says to these two kids, he says, okay, look, the trumpet section's kind of going to suck tonight, but just bear with us. So after I love this little vignette, after the dance and everything, and guys are sitting around and having a few pops or whatever, they have the two college kids come over, because you just wouldn't have been able to do this otherwise, or any other time, and they want to listen to their own recording, to hear how they sounded, to hear how the new people are being worked into the unit. And so it didn't come out for a long time, and one of the guys who taped it, he lent it to a friend. Lo and behold, it shows up on the European bootleg market, like at the end of the 1960s. Finally, this one of the original tapers says, I probably should make a better dub of this. And he ends up winning one of the only good, I think, Grammys in 1980, I believe it was, for this field recording from such an early vintage. Rock and roll, you couldn't get a good live recording until 1968, 69, 70. But here was Ellington in the middle of podunk America cutting some of the best live jazz ever heard.
And from there, as we continue today's dissertation from Mr. Fleming, we move to the Boston Bruins. Tie it all together, Colin.
I think this is just, it's very underreported. And sports teams change so much. If you have a habit like I do of going on pages like Baseball Reference or whatever it might be, and you hit that next year little tab, or you hit the previous season, you see how much roster turnover there is. The fact that the Bruins have five guys, who have been their core players going back to 2010 and 2011, and it never gets written about, blows my mind. You have Bergeron, Chara, Krejci, Marchand, and Rask. You never see that in any professional sport right now. These five guys, and a number of them are, well, what? At least two of them are Hall of Famers. Maybe three.
Yeah.
Because I think Marchand has a shot. Rask would have to win another Vezina and a Conn Smythe, I think. But that's, you don't see that in professional sports. I can't think of a single team right now in this age that has five core guys like that, not like some guy who just kicked around or left and came back. And they're having, I'm wrong. I didn't think they were going to be having the season that they're having after coming so close last year. It's such an attrition, a war of attrition in the NHL when you have, what, an extra 2 months to your season, and then right, you lose on the cusp at home at Game 7. And I don't know for the life of me why Bruce Cassidy does not get more credit as the coach he is.
I agree.
You hear Brad Stevens all the time, but Bruce Cassidy, he tells it exactly like it is. They lose the game. Rask lets in this off when he says our goaltender wasn't good enough tonight. I'm like, yes, I enjoyed that. Thank you. And the players clearly buy in. He doesn't alienate the room. And they're just flying under the radar right now. And this team is a President's Trophy team. This is a legit. This is the best Bruins team I've seen at this juncture of a season since like 82, 83.
And I'm not sure Chara will make the Hall of Fame because I'm not sure he'll ever retire.
Right. Chara is, I actually think he's better in this role. I never felt that he was this number one defender when he was being counted on to play 26, 27 minutes a game. I thought he was too often the pylon and he turned the puck over too much. But right now, with his role minimized and doing less, you're getting, I think, more from him. And he's able to be consistent and he doesn't have the turnover errors like he used to. Because McAvoy does a lot of the puck handling for that particular pairing. And though he is morphed, I know he scored the other night, into Rod Langway offensively, which he shouldn't. He has too much skating ability, for one, to be able to be at that level. But they've figured it out. And I think the best player on that team, I know Pasternak's having the big year, but Marchand is the guy who has been the best player on that team for a couple of years now. He is the motor that makes that team go. And he was the motor in the Stanley Cup playoffs a lot of times.
Right.
In 2010, 2011. I remember watching him be a one-man cycle. And if you play hockey and you happen to be listening to Downtown with Rich Kimball, watch Marchand's feet. He never stops moving his feet. They are so quick, and he's always generating speed through quick little crossovers. And that makes him so elusive as a skater, despite not being this huge burner. Now, it's obviously not the same, but that's where that's quickness. That's what Wayne Gretzky had. And quickness kills in hockey more than speed. Speed just looks cool, but quickness is what sticks the dagger in other teams.
Colin Fleming joins us every Tuesday here on Downtown. Check out his website, colinflemminglit.com. Mr. Fleming, thank you as always, sir. We'll do it again next week.
Okay, sounds good.